Hey everybody, it's me, Jen, from I Never Saw That. We've divided this week's episode into two distinctly separate parts, which are very different from each other. I'm going to do something different than we've ever done before, which is that I'm going to talk by myself a little bit about some Montana stuff that has come up lately. A few days ago, my friend Claire, whom I have mentioned on the show several times and was at the therapeutic boarding school in Montana with me, sent me an article about programs in Montana like the one we went to. I shared it in our Facebook group, so please join that if you haven't. It's a really great way to communicate about the show. But anyway, I also shared it on Twitter. So if you didn't see it and you want to read it, just let me know. Tweet at me or something. And I will send it your way. The article is called Fox Guards Hen House in Montana Programs for Troubled Teens. And I think it was published in a lot of different things. The one that Claire sent me was in the Revali Republic. It was also published in the Missoulian, which both are Montana newspapers or publications. But this article was written by Lucy Tompkins, which I just want to put out there because people should be credited for their work. So this was a very tough read for me, and it has brought up a lot of feelings, and particularly anger about my time at this therapeutic boarding school. So anyway, so that I can have some sort of organization in my brain, because otherwise I will just jump around all over the place, because that's how my brain works. What I'd like to do is just read or paraphrase parts of this article, just kind of go through it and share the parts that ring true to me and talk about them a little bit. Hopefully that's cool with you. If not, you can just skip this part. Oh, I should say though, content warning, there's going to be talk of suicide, trauma, and abuse. So if you're not okay with that, you really should skip this part. So the article opens by talking about a girl named Carly Newman, who committed suicide at a place called Spring Creek Lodge Academy about 15 years ago. This was not my school. She was 16, which was the same age I was when I arrived in Montana. I'm not going to give you the details about how she did it because, I don't know, you can read the article if you want. But it's a pretty common way of committing suicide when you are in prison or a prison-like situation. The article does bring up another suicide and a few other suicide attempts, but the reason that it opens with the story of Carly is because after that happened, the Montana legislature, I'm guessing due to public pressure, and this is a quote, vowed oversight of these types of for-profit, tough-love residential programs and their methods. And it's been 12 years since those watered-down measures went into effect. Part of what makes that part really interesting to me is that around the time that that was all happening, someone that I was in Montana with, actually only for a few days, she left just after I got there, but I've gotten back in touch with her. She, at this time, this was about 12 years ago when this oversight was being put into place, supposedly, she, and her name is Kat, she testified in front of Congress about the school we went to. And by the way, for some reason, for this whole year we've been doing this podcast, I've been really hesitant to say the name of the school or the names of the people that ran the school. And I think I've been worried that they're going to find out about this and sue me or some shit. But honestly, I've spent plenty of time being scared of those motherfuckers. So come at me, John Mercer. That's the headmaster of the school. His name's John Mercer. And he is the biggest source of my trauma from this experience. But of course, everyone who worked there played a part in it. And the school was called Mission Mountain School. If you look it up, you can still find some information about it. And I will post some stuff in our Facebook group as well, just in case anyone is curious. The school shut down several years ago now. And I assume that that is in large part due to the controversy that came up around, you know, Kat's testimony and other people's testimony. Anyway, she worked really hard on this. It was really badass. And she was reaching out to a lot of us at the time. Again, this was probably 12 years ago. And when she reached out to me, I got on these message boards that were about our school. And at the point that I joined, I was well aware that there were some fucked up things about the school, but I hadn't really allowed myself to go any deeper than that. I was even still in touch with a staff member from the school who happens to be John Mercer's wife, who I was close to while I was there and who I now feel incredibly betrayed by. But anyway, at this time, I still believe that there was a lot of good about the experience too. I mean, and I'm not saying there was no good. I mean, of course there was good, but this whole situation was incredibly just fucked up. So the good that came out of it was in spite of this place and these people. So it was at this time, and it was through those message boards that I really, for the first time, started to tap into these feelings about just how fucked up this all was, just how traumatic this all was. And I still would not have used the word traumatic. That's a word that I only started using recently. There's something about that word that I sometimes feel, I do this a lot where I'm always aware of other people's experiences and how many people have had just absolutely nightmarish experiences in their lives, you know, particularly people, members of marginalized groups and people of color and people living in poverty and, you know, trans people and, you know, the kind of like societal violence that those people have dealt with is huge. And I never want it to seem like I'm in any way comparing my own experience to that. So I'm really sensitive to that. That said, I'm just telling my own story. And this is a pretty fucking huge source of trauma in my life. So at the time, I chose to disconnect from it because I just couldn't, I wasn't ready to process it. I couldn't figure out where I stood. I didn't want to see the school in a completely negative light yet. And this was 12 years ago, so this was 10 years after I left the school. That's how powerful the Stockholm Syndrome really was. Kat used that term earlier today in a conversation we were having, and it's a very, very good way of describing how a lot of us responded to being there. So I don't remember if I gave Kat testimony. I know I wrote something. I don't remember if she used it. I don't remember. But I do know that if I didn't, I'm really sorry, because now if someone asked me to give testimony about how fucked up this was, I would be first in line. But anyway, another part of the reason that I had to disconnect was that it was through those message boards that I found out that one of the people I was closest to in Montana had died of an overdose. And the son of two of the founders of the school had also died, I think, by suicide. So however I feel about those people now, I still am just heartbroken about that. And it was all just too much to handle at once. So anyway, I will share Kat's written statement in our Facebook group, and I do that with her permission. Thank you, Kat. Man, I feel like I should tell some jokes in here so it doesn't get too heavy. Okay, here's one. Knock, knock. No, wait, that's not gonna work. Okay, you start. Super funny. So, we were lucky enough that no one at our school died while we were there. We were lucky enough that we were not sexually abused. I say that I don't 100% know that no one was sexually abused. I don't think anyone was while I was there. What really strikes me about this article is that this shit is still going on, even as other states move to crack down on for-profit residential programs for troubled teens. Many of the same issues that prompted the initial outcry here remain. Programs clustered in western Montana continue to operate with minimal oversight, sometimes charging parents desperate for help with struggling children more than $100,000 a year. So let's just stop there for a minute and talk about this. First of all, it wasn't only minimal. There was no oversight of our school. There was no oversight. I've heard people say that some people stopped by once in a while. I don't know who they were, licensing people or something, maybe. That did not happen while I was at the school that I recall. But even if it did, none of us would have said anything. It's so hard to, it's a cult. It's like a cult mentality is what happens to you in these places. You know, you fall in line because you fucking have to. And then you start to believe it. You drink the Kool-Aid and you believe all this shit. And part of that means that you believe all this terrible shit about yourself that you're being told. Desperate parents. I think we're going to come back to that in a minute. But as far as the cost of this place, I believe at the time I was there, I heard later that it was about close to like $20,000 a year while I was there. I mean, people mortgaged their homes, people spent their retirement, you know, people went into debt as a result of Mission Mountain School and places like it. In my particular case, I had wealthy grandparents, and so they paid for it. And those costs, by the way, don't include all the extra shit that you're forced to buy. So, yeah. And, you know, my level of privilege is something that I grapple with constantly. It's something I want to delve into a lot deeper, and I'm not doing that right now. But just know that it's something I think about a lot. So, these programs are usually state licensed. However, being licensed doesn't mean anything. Here's what the article says. The program's websites typically tout their state licensing, but while they handle children with sometimes severe emotional and behavioral problems, the programs are not overseen by mental health, child safety, or education experts. Instead, they fall under the Department of Labor and Industry and a board whose majority comes from the industry it regulates, licenses, and investigates. Members of the state board, called the Private Alternative Adolescent Residential or Outdoor Program, PAARP, either declined to be interviewed on record or did not return calls for comment. Well, there's a surprise. Here's some stuff that was found in reviewing the licensing and other PAARP documents, as well as court and law enforcement records. Not a single one of 58 complaints investigated in the 12 years of PAARP's oversight has resulted in significant discipline against any program. Now, I don't know what those complaints specifically were about. I can imagine, though, extreme forced exercise. Extreme outdoor activities, forced labor, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. I mean, these are things that were going on at programs like this, and they're still this is still happening. Unlicensed counselors care for children with sometimes serious emotional, physical, and mental disorders, including depression, trauma, suicidal thoughts, fetal alcohol syndrome, and eating disorders. I would add to that list grief as well. And of course, many other things. As you know, probably, if you know me or you've listened to our show before, I struggle with severe depression and anxiety. I was an incredibly depressed kid when I got there. I had had a close friend commit suicide a few months before. I was in a very vulnerable emotional state at a very vulnerable time in my life. I was 16 years old. What I needed were therapists that were therapists. These people had no right. They had no qualifications to be doing the shit they were doing. There was no research that showed that these methods were helpful or productive. They just decided that quote unquote tough love was the way to go. And when I say tough love, I'm not talking about like when your mom yells at you. This is a big one. This really struck me when I read it and made me angry. Students often have no way of reporting abuse to their parents because unsupervised communication may be forbidden for months at a time or is monitored by staff. I never had a conversation with my parents that was not monitored by a staff member. When we wanted to send letters, they were read by the staff members before we could send them. If people sent us letters, the staff members read them before we were allowed to read them. So in the beginning of my time there, I may have said to my parents, "Hey-o, this place is fucked. but I couldn't. And if you were to say something like that, there's no way you would speak to your family for probably months. And you would probably be put on work crew, and who knows what other punishments you would have had. I mean, how fucking oppressive is that? I mean, that just, it makes me feel claustrophobic and terrified just thinking about it. I do want to say, I was a mess when they sent me to this place. I don't think they made the right decision, but I do understand where it came from. And I understand how desperate they were feeling. They were terrified and they were scared and they were fucking desperate. And that is what these programs thrive on. They smell that desperation like blood in the water. And they convince parents that this is the thing that's going to save their kid. And they're very, very good at it. So while I will probably always have a certain amount of anger about being sent away, I also have a lot of compassion for my parents at the same time. And by the way, I've asked my parents to be on this show several times. They don't want to do it. So I'll keep trying, though, because I think, you know, hearing their side and what they were going through, it would be powerful. And it's important to hear their story, but they don't want to. So one program, Reflections Academy, has been sued 3 times in the last 3 months for failing to protect teenage girls from alleged grooming and sexual assault by an employee who has worked in the industry for 15 years. Am I surprised? No, I'm not. I am telling you right now, if the headmaster, John is his name, if John had physically with his hands abused us or sexually abused us, no one would have believed us. No one would have believed us. We wouldn't have even believed each other unless we saw it happen, because that's how powerful this was. That's how much control they had over us and how much they were able to manipulate our brains, the ways that we saw each other and interacted with each other. I mean, we were required to call each other out anytime anyone thought someone said something dishonest or did something, I don't know. It created this culture of constant fear, and it prevented us. I've told the story before that I was put on work crew. Myself and a few other friends of mine were put on work crew. I was out there for like a month and a half, maybe longer. But the reason we were put on work crew, and I, if you have a question about what work crew fucking means, just let me know. Ask me. I'll cover it on our next episode. We were being punished for having what they called a social structure. Now, they had terms for everything. I wish I could remember all the terms. First of all, everyone was a tweaker. So the actual meaning of a tweaker, like a person on speed, it wasn't used that way. It was every single one of us was a tweaker. So social structure meant, all it meant was that we were friends with each other. And what that meant to them was potential mutiny. And I'm telling you, they were right about that. Fuck, it makes me so mad, because if we had been allowed to be close to each other, there would have been a point where we could have looked at each other and said, this is fucked up though, right? And they knew that. So they separated us. They punished us in front of the group. The entire group turned against us, because that's what they do. That's what you do there. I don't hold that against anyone, because I did that to people too. You are absolutely, you are a pariah. And they, oh man, I just remember John took such glee in making us pariahs. Websites and promotional videos for the programs tend to show lodge-like facilities ringed by trees and smiling students hiking or petting horses, testament to the mental and physical health benefits of vigorous outdoor activities. Those images belie a reality, at least for some students, of harsh physical punishment, controversial confrontation therapy, and isolation for emotionally fragile or even suicidal students, according to lawsuits against some of the programs, documents outlining the program's procedures, and interviews with former students. So even in this article, even the photo they use is exactly what was just described, and it does look very similar to the place where I was. It's not the same place, but you can see a snow-covered lodge-type building and some other buildings, and it's just in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And that's done intentionally. And this is also addressed in this article. These places are located in the middle of nowhere on purpose. Of course. Why? Because number one, if you want to run away, there's nowhere to go. Now, I did run away. I've told this story on a previous episode quite a while ago, but just briefly, I think it was 3 days after I got there. Hey, listen, I don't remember dates of anything or days of the week that things happened, or I do not remember things like that at all. Even last week, I don't remember, but I remember this, and that's how I know how fucking traumatic this was for me. I arrived on Tuesday, August 16th, 1994. So on Friday, August 19th, 1994, I ran away. I had been, for the last few days, stealing food from the kitchen, which just meant like an orange or an apple, you know, at a time. No, we were not allowed to just eat an orange or an apple. Are you kidding me? No, that's stealing. Food is a whole other topic that I'm not going to get into here today. So I had a few oranges, a couple apples, and I stuck them in my backpack. I brought my teddy bear, Bruno, who I still have. I brought my Walkman. I wish I could remember what I was listening to when I walked down that road. I don't know what it was. But, I mean, they took away most of my music, so it must have been, I don't know what it was. But I probably brought a change of clothes or two, and I waited until everyone was asleep. And around midnight, I snuck out the back door of our cabin and started walking down the road. We had a driveway that was probably a mile long. So I walked all the way down the very long, very dark driveway until I reached the highway. The highway, it's a two-lane road. And I just, when I got there, it was completely dark and deserted. I just picked a direction, started walking in it. And when the first car came by, I stuck my thumb out. It was going the opposite direction that I was walking, but I did not give a shit. I just needed to be anywhere but there. It was a truck, little pickup truck. Truck stopped, picked me up. Turned out to be two very drunk men. They had a cooler of beer in the car. I remember them asking me questions. I don't remember what I said. At one point, they pulled over, stopped the truck, left the headlights on, left me in the truck, and just got out, walked a few paces, and had a conversation with each other in the headlights with me sitting in the truck. I was absolutely certain at that point that I was going to be sexually assaulted or murdered. And I thought about running, but once again, there was absolutely nowhere to go. So I stayed in the truck. Thankfully, by some miracle, I wasn't sexually assaulted or murdered. We drove to Whitefish, Montana, which was, I think, about 3 hours from Condon, Montana, which is where the school is located. It's not even a town, but it's technically a town, but it's like a post office and a coffee shop. So we got to Whitefish. We went to Denny's. They dined and dashed. I made a phone call. I chose to call my mom. Why I did that, I don't know. I had friends I could have called that would have driven to Montana to get me. But I called my mom. She flew out the next day, showed up with one of the counselors from the school, took me back to the school. And I did not try to run away again after that. But that's a very rare story. I don't know of anyone else who ran away as successfully as I did. I mean, I could have gotten away if I would not have called my mom. But that was due to stupidity and a lot of luck. I mean, I guess courage. I'll give myself that much credit. It was a pretty brave thing to do. But, you know, there's a fine line between stupid and brave sometimes. Their wilderness or outdoors nature is no exaggeration. Most are located deep in the pine forests that once nurtured Montana's timber industry, miles from the nearest towns, which themselves are just dots on a map. Yeah, exactly. And by the way, this is going back to a previous thing about how they sell these places to parents. When we arrived at the school, we pulled up, and the first thing I saw was a group of three girls wearing very brightly colored t-shirts, skipping with their arms linked and smiling. And my reaction was, oh my God, they're Bible thumping clones. That's literally what I said. Turns out they were not Bible thumping, but they were definitely brainwashed. When I think back on that now, oh my God, it's like my instinct was right. You know what I mean? My instinct about that place as soon as we got there was correct. Even though later I was able to, like, it was such a funny story that I told later about these happy girls who were just happy and how I saw that as something bad. The Fox Guarding the Hen House is such a good title for this article and such a good fucking metaphor for what we went through there. And I think, I mean, we were stranded, literally. We were abandoned and stranded and left in the care of completely unqualified people. I mean, to be honest with you, I think most of the people, that might be generous, but I do think most of the people who worked there thought they were doing something good. I think John Mercer is a fucking psychopath, but most everyone else, I think it was more complex than that. And John has two daughters of his own, by the way, and is still married to Colleen, and supposedly everything is just fine, so I don't know. I just can't imagine that his daughters don't deal with some of that cruelty from him, too. Hopefully they don't. Hopefully it was just directed at me and some of the other people I was there with. But yeah, he's the fox guarding the hen house. There was nothing we could do. We try to stand up, we get eaten. I mean, we try to stand up. We had Sarah Fontana, a dear friend of mine, on this show several months back. It was our The Mask and Montana episode. Hey, listen to it if you haven't. But when Sarah first got there, or a little while after she'd gotten there, she refused to eat mayonnaise or drink milk. They continued trying to force her to do so. She kept saying no. They kept trying to force her. And guess what happened? After, I don't know, a few days, we all moved out into tents, into the woods. And we spent our days chopping wood and doing other hard labor. We were out there for months. So I think I'm done talking about this. I'm sorry if this is too long. To be honest with you, I don't know how much you all want to hear about this experience. I know I really, really appreciate how many people have connected to this part of our show. I really, really appreciate it. It's really validating, and it really helps me keep going with the show and with telling this story. And, you know, the more I kind of dig into it, the more I realize how much of an effect this has had on me in my life and how I feel about myself. It's affected every relationship I've had since, I'm sure. And I now am calling it trauma because that's what it was. And yes, people have been through much, much worse trauma than I went through. But I can't keep belittling my own experience because of that. You know, when I read this article, I read that, you know, people had committed suicide at a couple of these schools. And one of my first thoughts is like, well, it wasn't that bad at our school. It wasn't that bad. Maybe I'm just exaggerating all this stuff. It wasn't that bad. People weren't committing suicide. I mean, what a fucking bar to set. So anyway, thank you so much for your support. If this resonates with you, please let me know. If it doesn't, just don't let me know. And I just, you know, our show, the focus of our show is not this experience. You know, the focus is pop culture within the context of this experience. And then I sometimes share parts about this experience. And I think that this has been a really powerful vehicle for me to to work through some of this stuff. And the fact that we're talking about silly ass pop culture and doing it in a funny way and making people laugh is just wonderful. I mean, I honestly think the biggest compliment right now, at least, that someone can give to me is that I made them laugh, that I'm funny. There's nothing better than that to me. So it's kind of been a perfect way of putting comedy and joy out into the world and also telling this story that's real and painful, and everyone can relate to pain and trauma. So anyway, I love y'all very much. Thanks for listening to this. Check out the article. It's in our Facebook group. If you want me to send it to you, let me know. If you have questions that came up listening to me talk about this, please let me know. Tweet at me. Post them in our Facebook group. You can email us. It's info@ineversawthat.com. And I will absolutely answer them. All right. This is a very strange tonal shift with Johnny Mnemonic, which is one of the silliest episodes we've done in a long time. So you're getting both ends of the spectrum this week. Thank you. I love you. Until next time.